The Asian Classics Institute presents How Karma Works with Geshe Michael Roach, recorded live in New York City in November of 1994. This is the beginning of Class 1.
Books in the monastery. The plan of the five-year course is that you spend a year on each, but maybe one course each year on each. So you have done higher Madhyamika school twice already. You've done the lower Madhyamika school, and you've done the Sutra school. Okay, you've done the logic school already. You've been introduced to those three. Abhidharma is a new school for you. Normally in the monastery, in my monastery, we don't do it till our 15th or 16th year. We had a real rare opportunity with Rinpoche, started in 1974 or 75 to teach Abhidharma, and he taught it for 10 years. And we went through the whole text. Some people memorized it, and I was lucky, and I got the whole thing and memorized about half of it. And we translated the commentary by the first Dalai Lama, which is one of the things that made him famous, and then after he died, they decided he was the first Dalai Lama. So he was a student of Tsongkhapa, Jet Tsongkhapa. The commentary by the first Dalai Lama, which is one of the things that made him famous, and then after he died, they decided he was the first Dalai Lama. So he was a student of Tsongkhapa, Jet Tsongkhapa. So that's, I love Abhidharma. It's very dear to my heart, and this is your first introduction to Abhidharma. We're going to study the fourth chapter, which is dedicated to karma. And it's probably the best presentation of karma, if you don't count Jet Tsongkhapa's Lama Rinchenmo. So we're going to spice it up with a little bit of Lama Rinchenmo. So the first class will be an introduction to Abhidharma. You know, everybody throws around the word Abhidharma, and nobody knows what it is. There are a lot of strange books out called Abhidharma that have nothing to do with Abhidharma. And you'll know that after you finish tonight's class. And then a little bit about the school, where it comes from, the school of philosophy that started Abhidharma. The second class will be a little bit about what is karma. And we've spoken about it before, about how actually a movement of the mind is the basic kind of karma, and we'll talk about it. And then the detailists, and they're the Abhidharma school, they believe in a certain kind of special colors and shapes, form, I should say, physical matter that you can't see, that has to do with ethics or your morality. we'll talk about that. It's a very special idea of their school. Number three, we'll talk about the different kinds of deeds, bad deeds, good deeds, what makes a good deed, what makes a bad deed, and what is motivation, how does motivation affect it. Number four is we're going to talk about karma and what you get back. You know, what kinds of results do you get from certain kinds of karmas? And we're going to use Jetsun Kapa mostly for that, and then we'll also refer to the first Dalai Lama. I felt like the Abhidharma doesn't really explain how karma is carried with you until it comes back to you. It's not very detailed on that. So I have found Jetsun Kapa presented the mind-only school in his masterpiece on emptiness called Gombo Rapsa. And there's a beautiful section in there about how karma is carried, the way in which karma is carried. And that's presented by the mind-only school. And that's actually accepted by the higher schools. We accept their presentation of the mind, of how karma is carried. We also, by the way, accept, even the higher schools accept the Abhidharma presentation of karma. Well, almost everything. Okay. So we're going to talk. I think it's important for a Westerner to hear a decent explanation of how karma is actually carried. Otherwise, it's hard to accept it, for me. I love that explanation. It's a really good explanation of how karma stays with you. Number six is even more interesting, which is what's the relationship between karma and emptiness? And why does there have to be emptiness for karma to work? And why was it Tsongkhapa's, what do you call it, fixation? Or he was fanatic about the fact that karma and fixation. Or he was fanatic about the fact that karma and emptiness are interrelated, that morality and emptiness are dependent on each other, and that they are closely intertwined. And he felt like most schools were either emphasizing one or the other and missed the whole point that they are interrelated. So we're going to cover that from the monastic textbooks of Serame, which are the best ones. Class number seven is... there's a thing called black karma, white karma, and there's a very important concept called path of karma, or path of action. And then we're going to get into the 10 root non-virtues. Okay? And we'll talk about those. Class number eight. There's a concept called most basic virtue, which means the storehouse of virtue within your consciousness, within your mental stream. And there's a way with certain mistaken actions that you can destroy that. And I thought we'd better get into that. That's a very important concept. That's a very important concept. The Abhidharma takes a lot of time to explain it. And I think we better know about it. And then there's the distinction between projecting energy and finishing energy. Karma has two different ways of producing its result, and we're going to study those two different ways. Okay? Two kinds of energy that karma has. Class number nine is the five immediate misdeeds means immediate bad deeds means after you commit one of these in your life, and if you leave it unconfessed and unpurified, then right after you die, you go to hell, the lowest hell. That's why they're called immediate. There's no other birth between that and the hell. You go through a bardo, but then you go straight to hell. There's no other birth between that and that life, and the next life is in hell, the lowest hell. So we better know what those five are. And then the idea of a schism. Schism means one of the most serious, maybe the most serious bad deed you can do of the five is to split up the Sangha, is to cause a division among practitioners of Buddhism. You know, that's something that technically we can't do. It has to be done during the time of the Buddha. It has to be... There are a lot of things that you should know about that. But we can do what's called Jetumba. You know, we can do something similar. And we're very close to that. I know I am. You know, I live with monks. It's very easy for me to criticize one monk to another monk. And that's... or even just fellow students. And that in the higher teachings, that's a very serious... infraction of your vows. So I think we'll spend some time on the idea of being careful not to split up the sangha. And then number 10 is what bad deeds are more serious than other ones, and what makes the same bad deed more or less serious. Okay? And what makes a good deed very good. Okay, so we'll study that. You know, you can't do all the good deeds that are possible, and it's important to prioritize them. You know, so we'll talk about that. So that's a quick look at the syllabus. It's my intention to finish by December 4th or 5th or something like that. I mean, I don't intend to go overseas, and I don't intend to miss any classes except what's on here. So, you know, we'll try to finish in time for Christmas or holidays, whatever. You know, you have to go be with your families. And I want to finish well before the holiday season starts. So I'll do the best I can to do it. I don't see any problems. But, you know, karma will tell. All right? So we'll get into Abhidharma. Any questions? Anybody have any?
Do you have any idea when you can start your class, the course after this one?
I would guess around March. In February, I'll probably be in retreat. And January, I have to go to the debates. Although that might be moved up. I'm almost sure it'll be March. And we're going to try to send an announcement out like a month ahead of time. Anila's very good at New Nicking, and Margie. So. We're getting more organized, right?
A little bit.
So. All right. Okay. Abhidharma is a Sanskrit word. The Tibetan equivalent is Chö Mumbo. Please say Chö.
Chumumba.
Right, we'll get into what it means later. All right. It's one of the very first forms of Buddhism that came in India. It's around the third council of early Buddhism. So it was one of the first forms of Buddhism. It's a Hinayana form of Buddhism. Right. So some people call it Theravada or Hinayana. And Hinayana basically means, in Tibetan, it's explained as a school where people are working mostly for their own liberation, or to become a Buddha, but not mainly. They cannot really relate to teachings where you're supposed to do this for the sake of all sentient beings. In Tibetan, the word Hinayana means low capacity, small vehicular capacity. The word Tekpa means vehicular capacity, how much a truck can carry, how much a wall can hold up. Okay, so it's a Hinayana school. And just, you don't have to know it, but we're studying the Sarvastivada tradition. There were 18 divisions of it, and long story, okay? The main book, this you have to know, that all Tibetan monasteries use for the study of Abhidharma, and basically most of the great scholars of each of the sects, you know, whether of the tradition, Sakya, Galupa, Kagyu, or Nyingma, most of the great scholars have used this root text. And that's called the Abhidharma Kosha. It's a long word. In Sanskrit, there's no dividers between words. I mean, the sentence just goes on without any spaces between the words. And when two words like have an A that meet together, it forms a new long A, and then you can't break it up for people. It's difficult to make it convenient for people. You just have to write it out in this long string. So say Abhidharma.
Abhidharma.
Kosha.
Kosha.
Abhidharma.
Abhidharma.
Kosha.
Kosha.
In Tibetan, it's Chö.
Chö.
Numba.
Numba.
Zö.
Zö.
Chö.
Chö.
Numba.
Numba.
Zö.
Zö.
Okay. That's the main root text that we will use. And that's the main text used in all Tibetan monasteries. It's about 150 pages. So it's a long story to memorize. But it's a nice book to memorize. Okay, this is the author's name, Vasubandhu. Say Vasubandhu.
Vasubandhu.
And the Tibetan is Lopen.
Lopen.
Yignyen.
Yignyen.
Lopen.
Lopen.
Yignyen.
Yignyen.
The Tibetans translated most of the Sanskrit names into Tibetan by syllable, which is why Tibetan is so famous for translating Buddhism accurately, because they were fanatical about translating every single syllable even though it didn't make any, it didn't have any meaning in some cases. You know, yik nian, nobody knows what the words mean, you know, they have to translate it. So, it basically means wealth of the earth or something. It didn't have anything to do with, it wasn't a descriptive name that I know of. He was the author of it. What's his brother's name, half-brother?
Asanga.
Asanga. Okay, he was the half-brother of Asanga. You know the story,
yes, his
mother, was
a
nun. She had clairvoyance. She saw that if she had children, and she saw that Buddhism was declining in her times, and she saw that if she had children, they would become some of the greatest masters of Buddhism to ever live. And so she purposely disrobed. She had one son by a king, one son by a Brahmin. And they became, those two became the two greatest scholars of Buddhism ever, if you don't include Nagarjuna and Judson Kapa, probably. They wrote most of the books that we study in the monastery. They wrote the whole Asanga, went, and with Maitreya wrote the great five books of Maitreya. And then Nyingnyen is responsible for the Abhidharma. Was he Hinayana follower? No. But he wrote the book about Hinayana. Why? We'll talk about it. Hinayana is a valid school. The Buddha taught it, and it has its use, or we wouldn't be having this class. We'll talk about it. What are his dates then? If he was
60.
Yeah, good. Okay, 358.
What was 630?
630 is Dharmic Kripa.
Oh.
Who cares? I mean, we... anyway, if someone asked. They don't really know the dates. I'll tell you, they even think there might have been two Vasubandhus. I mean, that's how little we know about them. I mean, scholars, modern scholars, believe there may have been two Vasubandhus.
He wrote so much.
Excuse me?
Because he wrote so much?
He wrote such a beautiful description of Hinayana, and then Vasubandhu also wrote on Mahayana. Fantastic books on Mahayana. They're both in the Dengar. So Western scholars can't believe that the same person would write from the Hinayana very well and then go and refute himself. But actually he did, and he wrote this. I believe he wrote the Abhidharma Kosha as a confession for putting down Hinayana. He wrote the main text as a confession for making that big mistake. Anyway, those are his dates. If somebody asks you, what are you studying? Okay? You say, Zhe. Can you say Zhe?
Zhe.
Zhe. Okay? Tibetan monks, the people in Tibet, when they're studying Abhidharma, they say, Kosha. What are you studying? Kosha. It's like, yeah, man, I know what I'm talking about. You know, so it's, as I mentioned before, it's very important to know what you're studying. You know, you'll meet some Tibetans, you know. I know some of you have met, there's some big lamas in town this week, three. And they say, what are you studying? You can show off. And you say, tsuh, you know. And then if they don't quote anything, you're all right. I was in a car with Ling Rinpoche. And Rata Rinpoche was there, Kyolan Rinpoche. And he said to Ling Rinpoche, oh, Michael knows Abhidharma. So Ling Rinpoche quoted the first two lines in the second chapter, which I had read the day before. And I explained it beautifully. You know? And then he quoted the next two lines. And I didn't know what he said. So it's cute. He said, it's all right. So you're studying Kosha, Abhidharma Kosha. Now, what does Abhidharma Kosha mean? What does Abhidharma mean? There's been some popular Western books written, you know, where they claim to be explanations of Abhidharma. I've never read them, so I don't know if they are or not. I doubt it, because they're so skinny. Maybe. But Abhidharma has the following meaning. The word Abhi, or Mun Ba, means, it's a very hard word to translate, and it means up to something, or approaching something. You know, right up, you know, I don't know what to say, just about to reach something. You know, it means up to, or to. Dharma is a famous, you know, very famous Sanskrit word. And the Tibetan is ch. And it comes from a root, in Sanskrit called dhr. And dhr, D-H-R, okay? Dhr means to hold something, right? Dhr. It comes from this root in Sanskrit, dhr. Dhr means to hold something, or to keep something. So what's the main meaning of dharma? I mean, the main meaning of dharma, aside from meaning teaching, is what?
Phenomena?
Existing thing, phenomenon, any existing object is a dharma. Rangimo zimbe na chus, that's the definition. Anything which has a nature, anything which does its own nature, okay? Anything which holds its own isness, anything which has its own identity, okay? That's why a dharma comes from dhr. Dhr means to hold or to possess your own identity, to hold.
So you don't mean it in the same context of what we just studied as an existing thing in the last class, anything which is valid perception?
That was pramana. That was sima. Pramana.
Wasn't the definition of an existent thing something that you perceive?
Oh, seme nipa yupitseni. The definition of a dharma, another definition of dharma, actually a synonym of dharma, is anything which perceived with a pramana, with a sima. Anything which you see with a normal perception. You're not drunk, you're not crazy, you're not jealous. Really there. So dharma, chur means existing thing. If you don't know Sanskrit, you see the explanation in Tibet, it doesn't make any sense. It holds, so it's a dharma. And the pun doesn't come through in Tibet. But they translated it religiously, you know. And then later scholars forgot what it meant. You know. So that's why dharma is called that. Dharma, teaching dharma is called dharma, the books say, because it holds you from the lower birth. That's why it's dharma. It's keeping you out of the door to the lower realms, okay? That's the function of dharma, as teaching. So dharma means existing thing. Dharma means anything. The wall is a dharma. John Stilwell is a dharma. New York City is a dharma. You know, your boredom is a dharma. Those are all dharmas. Any existing thing is a dharma. What is the highest dharma?
Buddhahood.
Okay, Buddha and Buddhahood. But what about if you're Hinayana? What's the main emphasis?
Nirvana.
Okay. So that's the highest dharma in the, you know, the Abhidharmas. If you ask an Abhidharmas to say, he's likely to say Nirvana. So in this case, in the word Abhidharma, the dharma they're talking about is Nirvana. Okay. And what's Abhi mean? Up to. So Abhidharma is the thing that takes you to Nirvana. It brings you to Nirvana or brings Nirvana to you. They explain it both ways. That's the literal meaning of Abhidharma. It means the thing that takes you to Nirvana or the thing that brings Nirvana to you. Up to you. And what is that? You know, all together, you could draw a big circle around it. You know, what is the thing that takes you to Nirvana? What's the main thing you need to reach Nirvana? What's the main thing you need to know at your office to stop your bad thoughts and reach Nirvana?
Emptiness.
The knowledge of emptiness. Wisdom. Okay, so actually Abhidharma means wisdom. Abhidharma is wisdom. It's Shara. Somebody asks you, what's Abhidharma? You say, wisdom. Well, what wisdom? Wisdom that understands emptiness. Ah, but in the Abhidharma, they don't call it emptiness. They call it selflessness. We won't get into that. Okay? They call it something else. They have a different explanation of it. And that's one of the main things that's devised in schools. It's their explanation of no self. They'll never call it emptiness in Abhidharma, except in one tiny section. So Abhidharma means shira, means wisdom. Okay, so now you know. Abhidharma means wisdom. What's kosha mean? Doesn't mean not non-kosher. kosher means a treasure or treasure house. Okay. Even nowadays in India, I deal with all these diamond dealers. Half of them are called Kotari. And the Kotari is the Gujarati version of kosher. And they came, you know, their grandfather, 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 grandfather was the treasurer of the diamonds and the gold. They stay in the same line normally because of the caste system for hundreds of years. So a lot of them are called Kotari, kosher. It comes from kosher. Kosha means treasure or treasury or treasure house. Okay, and that's a kosha.
So it's a zu?
Yeah, in Tibetan, zu. Like a pangzu means a national treasure house in Tibet. Potala had a pangzu in it. That was a place where they kept all the, you know, the gold and the jewels and stuff like that. That's a kosha. What do they keep? Why do they call it a kosha? Why do they call Vasubandhu's book a kosha? Because he stuffed into it all the jewels. What are the jewels? There are seven great books on Abhidhamma. Okay, there were seven original books on Abhidhamma. They were written down, or they were spoken by the very first disciples of the Buddha. People like Shariputra and Moggallkepu. They were the Katyayani Putra. These people like this were writing, they composed ancient books of Abhidhamma. There were seven great books of Abhidhamma. We don't even have them all now. And those jewels were collected by Vasubandhu and put into his book called The Treasure House. So he took that treasure and he put it into his book. And that's why his book is called the Kosha. So Abhidhamma Kosha means the treasure house which contains the precious jewels of all the information from those very, very early Abhidhamma texts, by the seven early texts on Abhidhamma, written by people like Shariputra and Moggallkeputra, who were direct disciples of the Buddha. And that's why it's called a kosha.
Was it written by the Buddha? Spoken by the Buddha?
Basically, all the Abhidhamma. By the way, Abhidhamma and Vinaya, those two Hinayana, of all the five books you're going to study, two of them are Hinayana. One relates to monk's vows. You'll never get very deep into it until you become a monk or nun. The other is Abhidhamma. That's actually the only two books that are studied in all the Hinayana countries. Like if you go to Ceylon or Thailand, they are studying, or Burma, they are studying mainly these two books, these two subjects, Abhidhamma and Vinaya. And there's a big fight about whether the Buddha directly taught Abhidhamma, and you can read about it in the reading. But he did speak it directly, and when you study Sutra, and when you study Vinaya, in the Kangyur, from the Buddha's own, what we have left of the Buddha's own speech, which is supposed to be only a drop of what was there before, you see a lot of the Abhidhamma is there. Basically, you can find all the ideas in Abhidhamma you can find in Sutra. Like half of the fourth chapter that you're going to study comes directly from Sutra. Half of the fourth chapter on karma is just explaining different ideas of karma as they come from the sutras. They quote the sutra and then they tell you why it's called that. So it's very, very ancient. It's very, very close to the original scriptures, the Abhidhamma. What's the school called that taught Abhidhamma? What was the main school that was engaged with Abhidhamma? It's called Vaibhashika.
Is this what you're calling detailist?
Yeah.
Same thing.
Uh-huh. Larry, this is all introductory stuff. It's not very interesting, but I feel like you should know it, you know? It's kind of, you feel funny when people ask you what you study and you don't know where it came from or who taught it or when it started or, yeah.
Is this like a collection, sort of an anthology, or is it a commentary, or is it a compendium?
It's what we call a shastra. It's what we call a denture. The denture, the basic structure of our Buddhist scriptures, you have 100 volumes of the Kangyur, which is the Buddha's own speech. Then we have 250 volumes of early commentaries on that. And this is in the category of Tengyur. This is a Dencha, it's a Shastra, and they are the early Indian commentaries on the Buddha's speech.
But is he explaining his sources? Or he's
sure,
earlier scholars,
yeah.
Or is he quoting?
He quotes half his. He's quoting the Buddha a lot. All he teaches comes from directly from the Kangyur. You can find it all in the original sutras.
So when you say,
but it's all spread out in 100 volumes, and Vasubandhu is making it all into a system. He and we'll talk about it after this break. He organized it into a system. Because if you try to study the whole Kangyur, forget it. You just get confused. It's spread out all over the place. And the Buddha is very, you know, he's omniscient, so he doesn't go into it very deeply. Sometimes he'll mention an idea in two lines. You know, the Maitreya's description of the Wheel of Life takes two lines. And the Tibetans, by the time it got to Tibet and nowadays, it's into hundreds of books, you know. He didn't even name the 12 links in Maitreya's book. So this is, it does occur in sutra, but you have to go find it. So Vasubandhu's great achievement was to systematize the whole thing into a very coherent flow. And people who don't know Abhidhamma very well, or who try to read it without any teacher, they hate it. They say, oh, it's too dry. You know, it's just long lists and categories and outlines and divisions. And, you know, but actually, the whole, it's like a whole encyclopedia of Buddhism.
I guess part of what I'm asking is, because you said that there were originally seven books, and most of them are lost now.
Yeah.
You don't have them all.
I'm not sure how many exist in Pali or Chinese, or, you know, but we don't have all of them.
So this doesn't.
I'm not even sure if we have any of them.
This purports to cover.
Yeah, it could change
what was in all of
the
them.
Subject matter of those early seven books. Okay. So this, the school we're going to study. Remember, how many schools are there?
Four.
Early Indian schools. I'm not talking Tibetan schools. Don't get them confused. I used to get them confused all the time. Because I remember the same problems you have that I used to have. You know, the four Tibetan schools you don't have to know for this class. It's the Sakya, Galupa, Nyingma, and Kagyu. And the Kagyus have a lot of divisions, and the Sakyas have a lot of divisions. Nyingmas have a lot of divisions. And the Galupas have their monasteries, and they all have their own books. And we're not talking those four schools. Those are the four Tibetan schools that started, you know, in 1200s or something. We're talking about the early, early Indian schools, the very early schools of India. Okay, there were four great schools. What are they in order, do you know?
Vaibhashika.
First one is Vaibhashika, which you don't have to know the Sanskrit name. I'll talk about it. The second
Animists.
One is
Sutras.
What we call Sutras, okay, Sautrantika. And then the Mayan only school.
Yogacara.
Okay. Yogacara or Chittamatra, same thing. And then the Majjhima schools, the middle way schools. So basically, what are the four schools in Tibet, in India, early India? First one is, we call it detailist. So you don't have to know the Sanskrit word, okay? I don't care. The word is detailist in English. Okay? Why are they called detailist? There was an old book called the Chidakshepa, the explanation in detail. And they loved that book. They were fanatics about that book. So everybody said, oh, they're detailists. And that's how they got their name. It's explained in your reading. The second group was called the sutrists. Sautrantika means sutra followers. Because they said, oh, all this Abhidhamma stuff is wrong. It's all made up by people. We only believe in the sutras. So they were called sutrists. The third school is mind-only school. Do they believe that everything is mind-only? Not really. And we'll talk about that in this course. When we get to how karma is carried, Tsongkhapa gives a very good explanation of why they're called mind-only school. Okay. And then the fourth school is middle way school, Madhyamika school. I put a little tiny, now that I have time, it's really fun to put the readings together. And I put in a little bit from Changya Rupa Dorje. He was born in the 1700s. You don't have to know all that. He wrote a text on the four schools. It's so famous that in Dharamsala at the monastery there, the logic school, they only study that book. They don't even study all the other five great books. They concentrate mainly on that book. He wrote a survey of all the Indian schools. And that book is so great that because of that book, and actually he was the second Changya. The first Changya was the teacher of the Emperor of China. So the Changya line, which had five great lamas, is very important for Buddhism. And when the Chinese, there's a Chinese library upstate New York, when they asked us to input some stuff for them, I said, we'll do Changya first, because he was the teacher of the Emperor. So we did that one first. So he explains, you'll see in the reading that the four schools were actually designed by the Buddha. And when you see explanations in Western, Western scholars try to prove that Madhyamika started with Nagarjuna and mind-only didn't happen until a Sangha was there. Well, Changya Rupa Dorje, he pulls out some tantric texts and he shows you that the Buddha taught it long before that. it was designed by the Buddha. Why? Why should he teach four schools and three of them are wrong? According to the level of the student. Okay, and we talked about the ground rules for establishing that in the last class. How do you know when the Buddha is just joking? What do you say? Not joking, but how do you know when he's just simplifying it for a student of a certain capacity and that it's not strictly correct? Then the ground rules we talked about in the last class. So it's not that the whole lower three schools are wrong. It's that they have a few of the major ideas in each of the schools are not actually correct, according to the highest interpretation. So why do we study it? They give you a very, very good step ladder to get to the highest school, to Majjhimika. And it's very, very good to study it. And when people say, and never make that mistake. In fact, it's the breaking your vows to put down Hinayana. It's very, very stupid, and it's not allowed by anybody to put down Hinayana. And monks in Tibetan monasteries study Hinayana, I would dare say, better than the monks in Sri Lanka. I mean, we spend more time on it, and we study it deeper, and we believe it. And all the monks' vows are all Hinayana. Everything that we do as far as the rules is all Hinayana. So it's great. It's a great system. It's a wonderful thing.
Like you said, three lower schools. Which ones are the three?
The detailists, the sutrists.
And the mind-only?
And the mind-only school. They each have ideas which are technically wrong, but they're very helpful ideas. And we're going to have one of them next week. It's called non-communicating forms. Yeah. Excuse me?
Did you turn off the air conditioner?
Yeah. Isn't
to call them lower and to call it narrow?
Don't forget what I said, lower capacity.
Lower capacity. Isn't that in some way an insult to those who
think that the word is memba. Memba means lower, inferior.
It doesn't mean
when you study Abhidharma, if you really, you know, anyone who puts down Hinayana doesn't know Abhidharma. Abhidharma teaches the six perfections. I'll show it to you. You know, I mean, everything. Nyingje Chenpo was there. Mahakaruna.
No, I just meant that the way it's called is almost a put down.
Yeah, you can say that. But it depends on your point of view. It just means lesser capacity. And it doesn't refer to that teaching system in Burma. It just means to any person who would not have the capacity to take on the responsibility of working for all beings. Now, you and I know that most of the monks in those countries are very concerned about all beings, and from that point of view, you call them Mahayana. If they're working for the benefit of all sentient beings, then even if they're studying Hinayana scriptures, they're Mahayana. And a lot of people studying Mahayana scriptures maybe don't care about all sentient beings, and then they're Hinayana. So, you know, don't get hung up in it. I mean, it's... When I hear about Sakya, Balu, Nima, you know, it's always in the West. I never hear the Tibetan monks talking about it. Don't worry about it.
Could you kindly say the Sanskrit word for the mind-only school?
Yeah, there's two. Chitta-matra is the technical word. Chitta means mind and matra means only. And then they're often called Yogacara, Nyamso Chitta. And there's a long story about that. You'll study it someday.
And the first three schools are... Excuse me, there was a subcategory in that.
The first two schools are Hinayana. The second two schools are Mahayana. Okay? The mind-only school and the middle way school are Mahayana. And the sutra school and the detail school are Hinayana. And there's only four. And the Buddha taught four. The Buddha designed it as four. He wanted it to be four. Each one has its special ideas and helps students get up to the next one. And they're all wonderful. Okay? I hope I never hear any student from one of these classes say, it's like, probably means you don't know what it is. Okay. All right, we'll take a break and we come back and we'll talk about the structure.
So the mind-only school is Mahayana, but it's also lower capacity?
No, it's Mahayana. It's higher capacity.
Oh, okay.
But it's, when I say capacity, I mean jnana. And jnana means tekpa, and tekpa means how much you can bear. Before the Tibetan time, they still carve it into the blocks before the Tibetan time. And one of the reasons is that it plants in the student's mind a propensity for Sanskrit in his next life. So, why do I put the Tibetan up here? It's 9 months. It's the Se Talam Sajay. Tar means karpa, means moksha, means freedom. Lam means path. Sel means illumination. The illumination of the path is the commentary to Vasubandhu's book by who? Who? The main commentary that we're going to study is by the first Dalai Lama. And I'll give you his name.
First commentary, first Dalai Lama?
The main commentary that we're going to use. I mean, the Abhidharma Kosha, by the way, if you ever heard it, Nabo Namni Dunshila, Wanjishila Nima Lo, Nabo Namni Dunshila, the five work towards the four. And the three act towards the three. And the four affect the seven. And that, the whole thing is like that. It doesn't make any sense by itself. It's a code book. It was written before paper. It was meant to be passed on from teacher to student as a song. And still is. But it doesn't make any sense by itself. You have to have a commentary. So we're using this commentary. The Tibetans don't call the Dalai Lama the Dalai Lama, by the way. They normally refer to them as Gyalwa, which means Buddha, or, you know, victorious one. So this is Gendun Drup. He's the name of the first Dalai Lama. That was his name. So, but we never call him Gendun Drup. You're not allowed, you're not supposed to refer to a Lama by his, just his name, like Johnston, Mr. Johnston. Gyalwa Gendun Drup, one of the first Dalai Lama. He wrote that book. His dates are, I don't know them, but you not going to know them. Okay, 1391 to 1470. He was a student of Jetsun Kapa. He's not even in them. I mean, normally you think of Gelsa Jay and Kid Jay, and he was one of the less famous students. He was, I don't believe he was around Tsongkhapa. I mean, I believe it was toward the end of Tsongkhapa's life. You know that Tsongkhapa passed in 1419. So that would have made him, you know, he was in his 40s when Tsongkhapa.
I'm sorry, Mike, I'm getting confused. And it's 1391, 14, whatever.
Yeah, those are the dates of the first Dalai Lama.
Oh, okay.
And his story is very beautiful, and we'll read it someday. His life story is very... He was, when he was born, he was born in a peasant camp, you know, a dropa, yak herders, and they were attacked shortly afterwards by some bandits, and his mother threw him in a cradle like Moses, I guess, and, you know, dumped him, left him out in the wilderness somewhere, and this big, huge bird came and protected him, and it's a beautiful story. And then he founded Tashihumbo, one of the great group of monasteries, after Devangandhan and Sera, that's the most famous monastery.
So this is the commentary of the Abhidharma.
Explaining Abhidharma. Yeah. This is the one that is used a lot in Gelupa monasteries. And that helped make his name. We don't even know when he wrote it. We think it may have been written down by one of his students as lecture notes. Normally we study another commentary, which I'm not going to write down. You don't have to know it. It's called Chimze by Chimjambe Yang. He lived long before Tsongkhapa. He was a Sakya scholar, and it's the greatest commentary on Abhidharma ever written, perhaps. And we study that a lot. It's very long, it's huge, it's 1,000 pages long. It's very, very good. So when people say, you know, are you Gelupa, or somebody just asked me on the phone this morning, I don't know. We study Sakya for the Abhidharma, we study Kagyupa for the Vinaya, you know, and we study Kadampa for the, you know, we use the best commentaries. Nothing else about it. So Gendun Drup is that's the commentary that we're going to use. Right? That's the main commentary. We translated it. It took about 10 years, 15 years. And one of these days it'll come out. I don't know.
Is that letter the fourth letter in a?
Good question. This is called a Dalok. It's for Sanskrit. There's a whole row of T's that don't exist in Tibetan. So the Tibetans took their T's and reversed them. To show that role. That's dick. Instead of dick.
So, but why are we writing it while we're writing the Tibetan that way? I mean, why do you want
Tibetan,
us to
Tibetan,
write
there's
it?
A few, there's many loan words from Sanskrit. Tika is a Sanskrit word, and we borrowed the word. We didn't translate it. I mean, Tibetans didn't translate it. They just used the Sanskrit word, tik. It's a corruption, if you know, tika. You don't care. Okay.
Thank you.
First dialogue. You'll mostly be studying that. It's a great blessing because that's really one of the first great masters of Tibet. And I think the present Dalai Lama would be very happy to know that people were studying his first book, you know. So that's kind of nice. Okay. I'm trying to watch the homework and see if that's kind of.
If you give it to me, I'll tell you.
What's the word Abhidharma refer to mainly?
What
is Abhidharma mainly?
Wisdom.
Shit up. There's actually two Abhidharmas. There's two kinds of Abhidharma. The main one is Shiva. I'm going to just start writing English because we're a little tired. I mean, Roman. This is knowledge. I translate it as higher knowledge because Abhi also means high. And then Jedang means
two S's. And what's the first word?
This is Shirab means knowledge.
Oh, Shirab. Okay.
And Jedang means, literally it means the things that hang on the thing. You know, like, I don't know, supports, baby ducks follow mom and dad. You know, it's like, not support so much as, Jedang means followers behind followers. So knowledge is the main Abhidharma. There are also things that are connected to knowledge, things that hang on to knowledge that are not knowledge, which are still Abhidharma. And you can read about those in the reading, but mainly they are, I'll tell you.
Michael, when you say main, you mean main focus?
I'll tell you in a second, okay? Knowledge mainly refers to, we say mainly in debating so we can't get caught later on because we forgot something. They teach us that. You know, you don't say it's that, you say, well, principally it's that. You know, then if somebody says, but you forgot that, you say, oh, that's what I meant when I said principally. It's an old debater's trick. What are the last three of the five paths? What's the big one?
I mean,
path scene is the big line, the big moment, the threshold, right? And then there's
habituation,
or sometimes called meditation. And then there's no more learning. Those are the three paths on which you've already seen emptiness directly. So in the Abhidharma, they are said to be the real knowledge. If you want real knowledge, real Abhidharma, you don't have it till you're on the last three paths. Basically connected to a direct perception of what? Don't say emptiness.
Selflessness.
No self. Abhidharmas don't use the word emptiness. They do, but in a different context. Okay, so knowledge is the three higher paths. What do you guess accessories to knowledge would be?
Meditation.
Yeah, the lower kinds of wisdom. Those are, you have a kind of wisdom now. It's not Abhidharma. It's not the higher part of Abhidharma. You have the wisdom that you were born with. For example, you have the knowledge that you were born with, the religious knowledge or the spiritual knowledge that you were born with, is an accessory to knowledge. Whatever knowledge you've ever gotten out of these classes, and the first kind is called Tujungi Shuram, meaning listening wisdom. You have that. You know, just classroom hours, raw classroom hours. The more hours, the better. That's Tujungi Shuram. That's listening wisdom. And you have that. You have some of that. The next one is called Samjungi Shuram. That comes from thinking about what you heard. But it's not to the point where you've had some direct realization of something. Okay. These are all even before the first path. Thinking about what you heard. And then there's Gomchungi Shuram, which is like, you do have some meditative experiences before you even reach the first path. You know, some... small enlightened moments during your meditation. Those are all accessories to knowledge. Another accessory would be the various stages of meditative concentration. Okay, the various, there's many levels of meditation. Those are all accessories to wisdom. And it's explained in the Abhidharma correctly. It's there. And it's in your reading. You have to be at a certain concentration level. You must be at that level. You will never perceive emptiness directly if you're not in that level. If you haven't reached that level, if you're not capable of reaching that level of meditation, you cannot see emptiness. You never will. And that's explained in the reading of meditation. So that's obviously an important accessory to knowledge. Is there any kind of physical matter which is an accessory to knowledge? What do you think?
Your brain? The
body.
Oh, you weren't in the last class, I can tell that.
you said
threw the brain out around about 2 months ago.
Well, you said knowledge. That is wisdom.
Abhidharma say there's a kind of vow. There's a kind of, when they talk about vows or vowed morality, obviously there's the monk's vows. Okay? There are other kind of vows. When you enter a deep state of meditation, you actually reach a state of a kind of a vow. Because why? Don't forget, Hinaya are mostly concentrating on the first 7 bad deeds. Those are what? Done by, how do you do them?
Body
or speech. They're mostly concentrating on those two. All the monks' vows are related to the first 7. They don't concern so much mental. The monk's morality is the first 7. So when you talk in Abhidharma terms, in a deep state of meditation, what's impossible to break? What? Which of 10?
7.
You can't break the first 7. When you're in deep meditation, you can't lie. You can't split up people by talking about them. You can't steal anything. You're in deep meditation. Okay, so that's a kind of vow. That kind of vow, according to this school, is a kind of physical matter. And we'll talk about it more later. Very interesting idea. This school.
But you mean when you're in that state of meditation, you can't do anything because you're meditating? Is that what you mean? Or because you've reached a stage of understanding?
The restraint, the condition of restraint, stays around you like a physical matter. And according to this school, that's a separate entity.
So even after you get up from meditating, you can no longer?
Oh, no, you lose it.
Oh, so it's only when you're in the.
It's an automatic vow. That occurs at a certain level of meditation because you can't break your morality at that point.
But when you're asleep, you can't lie or steal or kill either.
That's true. Maybe sleepwalker. That's true. Maybe you could write it in Vasubandhu or letter. that's a joke, but I can't impute you. It's a good argument. I guess if somebody ties you up, too. So those are the accessories to knowledge. Those two things together are Abhidharma.
So are you calling these the two divisions of Abhidharma? What would you call
these? Are two kinds of Abhidharma. These are both Abhidharma. The books about Abhidharma are accessories, but not real accessories. They're explained like that. They are nominal accessories. That you can call them accessories. They're not. They're related to knowledge, but they're not actually Abhidharma.
You can
call them Abhidharma, but they're not really related to wisdom directly. They don't attach themselves to your brain as you
start. I'm sorry, which ones are you?
Books. The books about Abhidharma. This whole class about Abhidharma. It's not an accessory to knowledge. It's close to an accessory to knowledge.
Well, I thought you said one of the accessories was listening to wisdom, which was
the mental function of wisdom. But not the words I'm saying or the books you're reading. And that, you can read it in the reading. That's a distinction that's made. They're called nominal. They're close to, no, what they're trying to say is the books are not Abhidharma. The Abhidharma Kosha is not Abhidharma. Abhidharma is a state of mind by which you perceive no self-nature so you can reach the mind.
Oh, that's...
Say it again.
Yeah.
This is a question on the whole verse.
No, it's very important. You know that. You know Prajnaparamita is not the books called Prajnaparamita. They help you get there, but they are not the...
The state of mind.
It's called analytical wisdom. Okay?
It analyzes
the no self nature. You know that. We talked about it.
Perceives.
We talked a lot in the last class about how it prevented what? if you had it in your mind at death, it wouldn't trigger your karma. Your karma would be a seed that never produced a sprout. It's very important. What you know by now, the only way you can get rid of your bad thoughts and achieve nirvana, which is the permanent riddance of your bad thoughts, right, is wisdom. And you know why. You know the example of the guy at work. That's it. The state of mind which understands the guy at work and the state of mind which creates karma are contradictory. They can't coexist in your brain at the same time. You can't collect a bad karma with someone if you're understanding their nature at that moment. It's impossible. You can't do it. That's the whole idea.
What about if you understand and you cannot help yourself?
Then you forgot. It would be like knowing that fire is going to hurt, not wanting to be hurt, and sticking your hand. It's impossible.
Yeah, but you can, let's say you know the food is bad for you and you still eat it.
Then while you're eating it, you're not concentrating on that.
Isn't that the habitual love?
I mean, the state of mind, if in you, it's described as contradictory. Your mind is like a tennis ball, okay? And only one thing can be in it at once. Either you understand that person's emptiness, or you have desire or hatred towards them. They can't be there at the same time. You cannot hate a person or desire a thing if you understand its nature. At the same moment, it's impossible for those two states of mind to reside in your brain. It's impossible. They're directly contradictory. The example is, you can't realize a scarecrow is not a man and also believe he's a man at the same time. I mean, you look at a scarecrow from a distance, you think it's a man, and then somebody tells you, oh, it's only a scarecrow, and then that realization that it's a scarecrow physically pushes out the other thought that he was a real man. They cannot stay in the mind at the same time. It's impossible. That's the whole point. That's the whole idea. Quick.
That sounds like you're talking about two extremes, like totally knowing something and totally not knowing something. And as somebody just mentioned in the previous class, in the class before that actually, we discussed a middle between the two where someone is on the way to developing that understanding, sees things that way, but doesn't believe them to be that way. So is that a mixed type of creation of karma there, or is it still absolute? Not until you fully understand.
Yeah, it has to be. Obviously, if you have a partial understanding of this no self, you can get into partial trouble.
But you said once you're an Arya, you don't collect any more bad karma.
Arya? Yes,
no.
You did.
Yes,
Arya,
you did. Yes, you did.
I have it written down.
I think that's what the book says. Okay. Maybe it means that you'll never trigger it. It does say that. I mean, there's a big debate about it. But we can go into it, but now you're going to be late. Okay. We have two more important things to do. Anybody who wants to stay after, we can debate.
Michael, your usage of the word knowledge there, accessories to knowledge,
yeah,
are you using that as synonymous with wisdom?
Yeah. When I say knowledge, I'm going to call Abhidharma knowledge. It's just convenient. Shara means wisdom, but Abhidharma, Chirurumba, means wisdom, means knowledge. I'm calling it knowledge, higher knowledge.
Because?
It just, you'll get confused. If Prajnaparamita is called perfection of wisdom, and I start calling Abhidharma wisdom, you're going to get really mixed up. So I choose another word. There's 20 words in Tibetan and Sanskrit for wisdom, and we only have two or three. I don't know why. All right. It's just the fact that it's very... When you get to translate a book like Abhidharma, when you get to about the seventh chapter, you ran out of words. You've got to start making up words for wisdom. You know?
So this is really about perceiving selfless...
It is, really. Yeah.
That's what the Abhidharma is.
Of course. Because that's the only thing that can get you out of trouble. It's the only thing that can stop your bad... habits.
And karma is just an aspect of this.
Shantideva spends a whole book on how to trick yourself out of your bad habits. And then at the end he says, but the only real way to get rid of them is emptiness. And that's why his last chapter is on emptiness. It's the only way to get rid of your bad thoughts. And that's the only way to reach nirvana. That is nirvana. So you literally can never make any progress until you see no self. Can't. You can't make any permanent progress. You can trick yourself into being good and it'll fail. You'll go bad. That's you know that. Okay. Eight chapters in the Abhidharma. Categories of existence. Okay. That's a small subject, right? The whole first chapter of the Abhidharma is devoted to dividing all existing things up. It's fantastic. When I think of Abhidharma, I think of that chapter. It describes the five heaps. describes the 12 Ayodhanas and the 18 Tathas. And the basic category is this. And if you know, if you want to know Abhidharma, you're going to have to know. They talk about stained and unstained.
Existence or?
All objects in the universe are either stained or unstained. If you want to know what stained means, it means having to do with your bad thoughts. Produced by them, producing them, or they themselves. Those are the three basic kinds. So stained, is this wall stained?
No.
It is. It's part of your samsara.
Isn't it with thought? Excuse me. You said thought.
Or related or producing, you see? Or produced by. You see, this wall is produced by your bad. We proved it in the last class.
I thought you meant just relationship to thought.
And this is very interesting. Maybe you've never run into an unstained thing in your whole life. And that's something to think about. All the objects in your existence, all the objects you deal with all day long, are produced by bad thoughts in your last life. Or they are producing bad thoughts now in you because of your bad thoughts.
And what was the third category?
Or they are bad thoughts. Your anger is a bad thought. It was also produced from previous bad thoughts. It's also going to create more bad thoughts. The wall can be an object of desire for you, or it can be an object of hatred. Or it was produced by your desire or hatred. These are all stained. Unstained things are extremely rare. They are the direct perception of no self.
But Michael, if samsara is the place of the state of mind, if the Buddha is sitting in the room, and then he sees the same wall. So does that make a difference?
He doesn't see this wall.
What does he see?
He sees no wall.
We're going to get into that in the seventh class, I promise.
Our current perception of the wall is stained?
Yeah.
That's what you mean. Not the wall.
No, the wall is stained. No,
our current perception of the wall is stained.
I say the wall is stained.
We will never be able to perceive a wall that is unstained. Unstained.
You are who you seem to be. That
we'll get into
wall is
it.
Stained.
It's a long subject. Basically, I'm saying this. Basically, don't lose the main point. The main point is every single object in your life is stained. It's rotten. There's something wrong with it. It came from bad stuff. It's leading to bad stuff. There are only a precious slivers of unstained things that you can ever experience before you die. And if you don't, then you're just going to get more of this. You know, what's wrong with this wall? You know, it's not so bad. Marge painted it, looks great. it's suffering. And you're suffering. As you look at it, you're suffering. You have to study. That's another long story. Okay. Chapter 2. The power. It's a very sexy name. What it means is, basically, the Abhidharma describes the faculties of perception that you have. Your eye, your ear, your consciousness. These are all ways in which you perceive the world. Those are called powers in the Abhidharma. The second chapter of the Abhidharma also presents the mental functions, which is Buddhist psychology. And that's a whole separate course. We'll probably do a separate course on that. It's very, very interesting. And the second main subject of the second chapter is, although it's not in the name of the second chapter, is how do all things occur? You know, how do caused things occur? How do causes work? That's the other main subject of the second chapter. I'm going to ask you on the homework, what's the connection between the chapters? And this is great. Nobody ever does this in the monastery. You don't get an introductory course in the monastery. They start talking right away. The categorized existence obviously covers all existence. But they don't go much into the faculties of perception. So the second chapter was written as an enlargement on the first chapter. The first chapter mentioned the sense powers and all those various ways, the faculties of perception, but it doesn't go much into detail. So chapter 2 was written to give more detail about the faculties of perception.
And they're staying.
In us, they're staying.
We're not talking about the sense powers.
They are included in the powers. There's 21 powers. Maleness and femaleness are a power, for example. You know, the very womanness of a person or the manness of a person is a power.
But faculties of perception are subsets of.
Right, they are. Technically, yeah. There are powers that are not your eye or your ear anymore. In Sanskrit, loka, in Tibetan, jikden. And this is the world, the description of the world. Third chapter of the Abhidharma is very interesting. It describes all the kinds of beings in the world. How many hells are there? How many kinds of hungry ghosts are there? How many kinds of devas are there? Where do they live? What kind of people are they? How big are they? How long do they live? The second part of that chapter is beautiful. You know, it describes the first inhabitants of this planet. What did they live like? How did they think? What did they look like? It describes measurement itself, time and space. Mm-hmm. It goes down to subatomic measurements and goes up to light years and multiples of light years. And it describes numbers from up to 10 to the 60th power. Each number has a separate name in the Abhidharma. Each 10. So it's very beautiful. They describe how planets are born, how the sun will supernova, how this world will burn up, how, you know, 1,000 other planets burn up that way. Where are they? How long does it take to get there? It's a very beautiful chapter. All suffering, though. Suffering world. Samsara. What is it like? Okay, who lives there? And that's the explanation of the bardo also, and what bardo beings look like. That's all in the third chapter. Who is suffering and where are they suffering? That's in the third chapter.
Who is and where?
Yeah. What kind of beings are suffering and where are those suffering beings suffering in? Mm-hmm. That's the
question. Was he supposed to be in some... I mean, how did he get all this information? Was he supposed to be...
It comes from the Buddha. He's omniscient.
He was supposed to...
He got it from sutras. He got
from
it from...
sutras, not from...
No, he didn't... we say he reached a certain level, and probably on the basis of that, he describes the path of seeing into 16 milliseconds. I mean, he's pretty talented guy.
It seems difficult that this would be in the sutras.
It is. No, it's all there.
It mean that all schools of Buddhism, I mean, all of the Buddhism in all parts of the world believe in the hells and all these other
places? Yeah, there is no Buddhist country that I'm aware of that doesn't accept the Abhidharma. I'm not aware of any country. I've been to most of them. I don't remember. Probably there's some sect somewhere that doesn't believe it. Okay, number four is karma. If someone's saying they don't believe in hells, then they're not a Buddhist, because they can't take refuge. Now, does that mean that you have to believe in hells right away? That's not true, because you just finished a class on the samurai. You can't see the hells. I'm only talking about hells. But, ultimately, it is a part of Buddhism. They do exist. They really exist. They are there. People are suffering there. And that's one big reason to be a Buddhist, to get out of that. But, you know, you don't have to believe it. Now, in fact, if you do say it's true, without a doubt, you're probably not a Buddhist either. Because a Buddhist is not allowed to say that. You know, you can say it sounds correct to me, and what I know that person describes suffering so well, it's probably correct, but I say be careful with people who say hell is an interpretation for a state of mind on this planet. No, not like that.
It's an actual different place.
Yeah, it's not a state of mind or some psychological problem that you might have. You know, when they get there, they'll know. Okay, karma. Number four, presentation of karma.
When you get there.
For saying that about that? By the way, why do they present karma after the suffering world? Vasubandha's commentator said, because some people think the world was created by the creator, and therefore it's necessary to explain why. Karma. That's what really made all this world. And so that's the interrelationship. So you see, it's flowing in a relationship.
So the suffering world comes after the powers, because you have to have the powers to experience suffering?
I don't remember why. Let me check.
Some people believe that's the relationship?
Well, the function of the fourth chapter is to refute those ideas and say, no, that's not true. It's not true that the world was made by something. The world was made by your past beings.
Yeah, but in the other chapters, doesn't talk about somebody making the world.
No, No, they're just addressing the idea that someone might have.
Oh, they do address it.
Yeah, that's the reason why karma is presented after the sun. That's the interrelationship between those two chapters.
So they mention about a god in the other chapters? Is that what you're saying? So what is
he saying? Says somebody who reads his description of the world might think, they might have been brought up to think, that somebody made that world.
Because it is talking about beginnings.
Yeah. But so he wants to talk about it. It says the three realms of suffering existence are treated only briefly in the first two chapters, and therefore chapter three was written for more detail. So you get this thing where chapter one does mention the powers, but not in any detail. And then chapters one and two do mention the world, but not in any detail. So the interrelationship between these three is to get more detail.
But why wouldn't it be, Michael, that they mention karma just to explain where did it come from? I mean, here's the situation, what caused it? Why did they say a god? What did they have to say? I mean, wouldn't that be more logical? No, wouldn't it be more logical to say that the reason karma comes forth because you give it a description and then you say why?
No, it's actually two parts. There's two reasons why chapter four. One is to disprove that it was made by a creator. One is to prove that it came from karma. Okay? That's what you want to say. He's disproving that it came from a being, and he's proving that it came from your karma. Why does mental affliction, meaning bad thoughts, come after karma?
Because it's all bad karma afflictions you can create.
It instigates you to make karma. It inspires you. It motivates you to create karma. So that's the relationship between chapter 4 and chapter 5. Chapter 6 is just called Lamdang Kansak, person and path. It doesn't say anything more. You can guess what it is. What would be the most interesting thing to know after figuring out that you're suffering, after figuring out that your karma caused it, after figuring out that your mental affliction caused that, what would be interesting to know? Yeah. So the person here is advanced practitioners. You know, how do you, a person who develops wisdom, and the path is wisdom. So the chapter 6 is called the person and the path, and that's what it means. Chapter 7 is called wisdom, and it's just more detail on chapter 6. Chapter 6 mentions all like billion kinds of knowledge, and chapter 7 gives you more.
Is that Shiro? Mm-hmm.
No. It is actually. Yeah, no, yes, she, in this case. And you know, there's only one word in English in the Sahaja. And then chapter 8. And by the way, that's all the chapters, and I think that's all the class. Dhabi Dharma? The commentary is 400 pages. How many pages are you going to do? Oh, no, this the commentary is 400 pages. The original is like, comes out to about 150 pages. Oh, balanced meditation, by the way, it doesn't mean what it sounds like. It's actually a description of a Buddha's knowledge. Normally, balanced meditation, what do you think balance means? Why did I choose that word? Some people call it equipoise or equilibrium. What are you balanced between what and what? You know, if you had the meditation course.
Constitution and Vipassana.
Agitation. That's why they translated equipoise or I don't know, equilibrium. It means you're between those two states. Your mind is not too wound up and your mind is not too slowed down. And it's just this bright, attentive thing that you get in a good movie and stuff like that. That's it. You know, you're like, you know, and too stimulated is bad and too sleepy is bad. But that's the two other extremes. I think that's everything. Oh, one more small sentence. Sorry to run over. That was your fault. A Buddhist book, just as a point of, it's in the reading, and I love it. The first Dalai Lama he copped some things out of a Sakya scholar named Chimjong Yao. And it's the four requirements of a good Buddhist book. Okay. In other words, don't read the book unless it has these four requirements, and that's on your homework. Okay. The first one is called Jojja. Should be something there. There's a big debate in the monastery. There was somebody who wrote a shastra about the teeth of a crow. And that's no Jojja, you know. Nothing to say. No teeth. Crows don't have teeth. Okay, anyway. Should be some subject matter. Each one of these four requirements of a Buddhist book, by the way, if it doesn't have these four, it's not a Buddhist book. It can look like a Buddhist book. It can be printed by a Buddhist book printing company. It can be written by a Buddhist monk. Everything. Sound nice. Doesn't have these four, you're not supposed to even look at. I mean, you're just supposed to tie it to the tail of a dog. And that's the old custom.
So what does that say towards the compassion, towards the dog, right? Yeah.
Okay. Subject matter and purpose. The subject matter has to reveal some purpose. It has to have some purpose. The purpose of the Abhidhamma. What is the subject matter of the Abhidhamma Koshi?
Selflessness. No, sir.
Literally, actually, it's stained and unstained things. You can, if you write that, that's nice. Stained and unstained things. You know, we're not even aware that all the objects in our life are stained, that all the objects in our life are worthless and suffering. You know, we can't even make this distinction. This stuff is nice, this stuff is bad. We can't even make that distinction. We don't even know the distinction. So the subject matter is what's dirty and what's not dirty. You know, what's going to help you and what's just more suffering. If you study Abhidharma for a long time, it's really weird because, you know, you get money and you say, you know, oh, the Sakche is stained. Everything is stained, you know. Everything has this stain. All the normal things in your life are stained. If you study Abhidharma for a while, you start to change your life. You get,
Michael,
it's a sort of a strange way to live. Everything
isn't it a perception stained. Of what? How you see those things? I mean, you may see nothing.
They are same. Suffering. Until you reach nirvana, they will cause you suffering. And they came from suffering.
Okay.
And they're going to lead to more suffering.
So it's not because you see them as stained, it's rather because they will cause suffering.
Partly. Mostly. Okay. Good one. Purpose. What's the purpose of Abhidhamma? What's the purpose of the Abhidhamma culture?
Describe wisdom.
To help you reach
nirvana.
To get
the student to have wisdom. Plant the seeds for wisdom in the student's brain. That's the purpose of the Abhidhamma Koshi. To give you that wisdom which you can distinguish what?
Stained and unstained.
Let's start with stained and unstained things. Okay.
Which is omniscience, right?
No. Last three paths, please.
Didn't we describe that as omniscience in the last course?
No,
knowing.
By the way, in the monastery, the teacher would hit you with his rosary.
Oh, we're not in the last.
And he'd say, put on your Abhidharma hat. You know, you're a Vaibhashika now. For 6 weeks, you're Vaibhashikas. Forget the Madhyamika stuff. Forget the Pramana stuff. You're a Vaibhashika now. In the monastery, they say, put on your new hat. You know? And you've got to defend the Vaibhashika now. You're a Vaibhashika now. Goodbye. Say, Nigu.
Nigu.
Nigu. Ultimate goal. What is it? Please give me my magic answer.
Nirvana.
Mainly nirvana. If a book that claims to be Buddhist is not giving you a very good information about how to achieve nirvana, it's not a Buddhist book. It's not worth studying. You shouldn't study. It's, you're wasting your precious lifetime. And as your brain starts to get like mine, you'll find those moments more precious. You want to spend your moments of your life that you're still young enough to think right, you know, and still healthy enough to spend some months on a subject. Spend it on a book like this. Don't waste your time on, some new age interpretation of Buddhism that's going to make you feel good for a while. You know, don't have time for that.
Are you saying that the book has to specifically address how to get to nirvana?
Yeah.
For example, if it's a book on the seven... methods of mind training.
That's fine.
It's not talking
that's
about nirvana per se.
Oh, it sure is.
It is?
Yeah. Does it have to state it directly? No.
That's what I'm asking.
No, it does not have to state it directly. But you know, something is going to make you feel good or make you calm. Come on, you know. You've got to get to... It's not going to... It's suffering. That kind of calmness is suffering. Okay. Relationship, what do you guess it means? What do you guess it means? No, relationship between the other three. Makes sense?
How you get from one to the next?
Yeah. You to get nirvana, you must get wisdom. To know what's good and what's bad, what's worthless and what's not worthless. To get that, you must what?
Study
the book. Study the Abhidhamma Kosha. That's what you're doing right now, okay? That's the book. The Abhidhamma Kosha does have these four qualities. These are the four qualities of a real Buddhist book. If a book doesn't have those four, don't waste your time. It's too precious. You don't have much time. You might die before you get it all straight. That's the four qualities of a good Buddhist book. You must have those four.
In chapter 7, its relationship to the previous one is that it's an elaboration.
Yeah,
it's a refinement.
More detail.
More detail.
Now, you mentioned you talk about causality in the second chapter.
Yeah.
And that's causality as distinct from karma.
Right. It means generally how it's.
So they have a different conception of causality that's not just.
Right. The karmic result is only one of, say, five or six kinds of results. Like. Did your mind come from your past deeds? I mean, the building is easy. You know, if I had better karma, I wouldn't be on 39th and 9th. Really. So that's a karmic result. But is your present thinking a karmic result? You know, that's a big debate. But that would be not covered by the fortune.
The present, I mean, it seems to me that would be more obvious.
We're excited about the religion. Okay, this is Kylie. Can you do the ending one? I like how to learn this. I wanted to do this. Thank you.
Sāshī prakī jāshīn etā shāṁ rīrā viṃshī nyandē yampādī sāṅgē shindu mithē uvāgī jokū nāmbā shīmā jūpā
This is the end of Class 1.